your manger dogs, swab the decks and hoist the sails. The guns on board be needing some proper manning. Pieces of eight and a fine wench on your arm, if your work be not too shoddy. Careful not to flounder too badly, though, or you may have to dance the hempen jig as we see you to Davy Jones. The Jeffy, my boy, on with the show.
Well, shiver me timbers. To our listeners from across all regions of the planet, welcome once again aboard the Robin Hood, flagship to the world's one and only cooperatively inspired charity podcast network. Live streaming today from under widely sprayed South Korean skies, you're listening to episode 51 of Pirate Radio Podcasts. I'm your host and ship's chief communications officer, Jaffe Ryder. After a well-deserved week-long shore leave, we're back with a vengeance tonight as we launch our regular feature show with none other than Bo, King of the Road Keeley. Speaking to us via California's infamous Slab City Desert Compound, over his 60-plus some years of living, jack-of-all-trades, Bo has pretty much seen and done it all. American adventurer, naturalist, holistic healer, veterinarian, professional athlete, commodities market consultant, independent publisher, and executive tour guide are just a few of the feathers in his colorful, rambling cap. Over the course of the next 90 minutes or so, we aim to explore topics ranging anywhere from his years of travel and adventure to life in Slab City, the humor of Elvis, and Bo's longtime friendship with one of the world's more highly skilled and controversial magicians, con men, and martial artists.
Aye now, here we be, setting out to sea on this week's installment of Pirate Radio Podcast Adventures.
Thank you for that introduction, Captain. Very colorful and novel. So, and speaking of the Captain and our episode 51... we recently had a week of shore leave, as our regular listeners will likely be aware of course. So, a lot of great rest and recuperation there. Well deserved, and many thanks, of course, to the Captain for allowing us to take a little time to kick back, relax, and patronize, visit, drop in a few of the local watering holes, and brothels, of course, in good pirate tradition. Today's show actually is going to be a little different. The way we've got things set up, we're actually running things through British Columbia, Canada, via somewhere in the vicinity, I'd imagine, of Slab City, California. We've brought on board just recently a new technical engineer, so it's great to have that kind of support on hand. Valkyrie, from out of Kelowna, British Columbia. Can you hear me, Valkyrie?
I can hear you loud and clear. It's a pleasure to be on.
Hey, that's great. Thanks for joining us, of course, and being a part of things. We're going to actually be featuring Valkyrie a little later down the road, a couple weeks from now, is what it's looking like. So she's got quite the story to tell herself. Great little YouTube channel in place that she's working on building up and developing, and just a whole lot of skills that she has at her disposal that we're really looking forward to making the most of as we sail along here through digital seas that lay in front of us here. So do we have Bo then on the line? I think we were doing a quick sound check there in the lead up to things. We seem to have him and we're hearing him pretty well. Are you there, Bo?
I'm here in Slab City.
Now, you don't have Skype, of course. That's why we're having to do things this way today. There are other people in Slab City, California, which I guess is about 2.5 hours east of San Diego, from what I understand, as the crow flies, or as, I guess, vehicles out on the highway. So how are things today in Slab City?
Slab Slab City is actually located near the Mexican border in the Sonora Desert. I'm sitting in a Hertz rent-a-car about 30 miles north of the Mexican border, just on the fringe of the Salton Sea, between the Salton Sea and the Chocolate Mountain bombing range.
Wow.
So Slab City is a town of about 200 hardcore year-round residents that's swollen with the snowbirds and the LOWs and the dirty kids to about 1,000 this month through the summer months, and then it'll get back down to about 200. Things are well here.
Was that a dune buggy, or what was that exactly? Some kind of Mad Max warrior racing on by there in the background is what we heard.
No, that must be clear in my throat. There's nothing around me except for open desert and the Coachella Canal. You might hear helicopters pass over or jets dropping 1,000-pound bombs. In the course of the next few minutes, I'm about 3 miles southwest of one of their main targets.
You're saying...
But right now it's peaceful. It's just me and the scorpions and the rattlesnakes and the kid fox.
So there's a military testing range just off there in a not-too-distant region. I know from, based on my research that it was a Slab City area. There was a lot of military activity going on there, including this Salton Sea location that you mentioned. What can you tell us about things exactly from a historical standpoint then?
Slab City began in about 1939 when the famous General Patton flew over in a small single-engine plane and looked down and saw nothing but what I'm seeing now. It was daytime, of course, and he says, that place is hell. That's where I want my boys to train. And training is what he was talking about for the African campaign in World War II. So hundreds of thousands, perhaps millions of troops have passed through here over the years. Bullet shells still come down the wash. I could walk a mile from my car here and pick up a couple shells, and they'll be dated 41, 42, and Patton his troops for training. As far as present day, I'm about a couple miles south of what's called Camp Billy Mitchell SEAL Desert Training Center. It's where they bring the SEALs out to get used to the heat, get used to a month of 120 degrees a day when the summer arrives.
Well, that's just amazing. So good old General Patton, huh? So I'm not sure if you know too much about his personal story or not, but there's a fair number of people that actually think he was murdered after there was multiple attempts on his life until they finally succeeded in having him killed. Have you read up on Patton?
Very good. No, that's news to me, and I will look it up. That's interesting.
Yeah, I'll throw you some links there after the show. Some really great stuff, well worth looking into. So, but just before we get too carried away here and too far along the road, well, let's see what Pirate Larry is doing over where he is. He's been kind of out of the picture for a little while here now, but I think based on the information that we're getting here, he's somewhere in the vicinity of the Scurvy Dog Saloon with a few of his Mexican amigos. Pirate Larry, not in the crow's nest today.
Yeah, that would be right, Jeffy. We're in the Scurvy Dog Saloon here, and we're partying with Mexicans. We're having carne asada tacos and guacamole and cervezas. And I got to tell you, Mexico is a great country, and there's great people here, and I'm just real happy to have them here. I'm happy to have right now they're outside around the campfire, but I'll bring them in a minute and have them say hello to you, hola, if you like. But yeah, we're here at the Scurvy Dog Inn tonight, ready to listen to Bo Keeley's stories, because this is going to be a wonderful show.
As far as the introductions are concerned, it's probably best we save that for the Rogues Gallery end of things, the after show. Of course, that's where we put our feature content together, which is reminds me, we've actually got a Patreon account in place now, finally. So people that have been following the show for a while and have been downloading episodes and tuning in and listening and, sharing with their friends or what have you, that's a good way of going about working on supporting us. It's with your backing that we're actually able to keep the ship afloat here. So do check out our Patreon account. We got the links there right off of WPRPN, right off the main homepage. And there's another link with PayPal, of course, too, over via our Podomatic. And don't forget, folks, half of all the net profit that we do generate here goes back, in accordance with the Robin Hood philosophy, back to the grassroots, to the people out there, the homeless, and those basically the up-and-coming projects, grassroots campaigns or what have you, any sort of worthy cause that we can focus in on and work to support. So, well, that's great, Larry. We'll check back in with you a little later in the show. Feel free to comment or chime in there with via Skype, of course. And speaking of which, we've got a number of people there in our streaming YouTube chat area, which is great to see. Handful of folks, including a new visitor, Hydro Dank, Bathtub Jen, of course. Let's not forget. Hey, Bo, without her help, I don't think we would have ever managed to do this show. So, what's the story there with you and Bathtub Jen? I guess the two you met a couple of years ago and really managed to hit things off.
A strange meeting in that I travel a lot. I've been to 105 countries and all 50 states many times, always on the move. At that particular time, about 4 years ago, I was sitting in a warehouse in Colorado Springs of a solar installation, a Rocky Mountain Solar, typing away at the internet about 11 o'clock at night, and phone rang, so I decided to answer it, and it was her, and she identified herself, and I said, who are you? And she said, well, I know such and such, Lucian Endicott was your neighbor a while back, and I'm drunk, and I just want to talk, and so we talked, and then the next night we talked, and the next night, and then I caught a train out of town, and we still correspond by Facebook and read each other's stories. We're both journalists. Actually, we've never met physically.
Lucian Endicott. She once mentioned that name to me. I know Pirate Larry sent me a little something in the lead up to today's show. I think I've got his name right, but he's passed away now from what I understand, but really quite the character. What about him is it that you would like to share with our listeners?
Lucian Endicott was the number one scholar in the U.S. back in the 50s. They tested all college graduates, and he came up number one in all U.S. Took a job with the fledgling IBM company. IBM was just getting started. Their computers were as big as refrigerators. And Lucian was one of the first workers there. So the first time I actually met Lucian was at an IBM reunion about 4 years ago in Colorado Springs. And there were six, eight of the former IBM programmers and the media people that gathered. And it was a kick because they were almost all as smart as Lucian, but not quite. He was the patron.
I think what Bathtub Jen was telling me, actually, is that she managed to meet him. They ended up being sharing the same apartment, although not specifically the same apartment, but rather they lived across the hall from each other, I guess, was the deal. And then it was through him, I think, that she met you. Is that correct?
I believe so, yeah. They lived right across the hall from each other in an apartment complex in Colorado Springs. And apparently, Jan used to go over and watch movie at Lucian's and read books to each other and so forth. And Lucian said one day, well, I know this interesting character, Bo, and he's living in a warehouse at a solar insulation company. Got to give him a call sometime. And so she did. That's how we met.
Just looking at his URL that was sent to me, just prior to the show, scrolling through things here, shared it with the folks on YouTube as well as Skype, of course, too. But just to be clear then, what in a nutshell, what do you think he will be best remembered for?
Probably Lucian will be best remembered for his son. It's a curious, twisting story. The way I met Lucian was through Marcus Endicott, his son. I was riding a freight train through Nebraska on the first transcontinental railroad that runs from Sacramento through the Golden Spike in Utah and on to Council Bluffs and then into Britt, Iowa, where every year since 1909 there's been a National Hobo Convention. So there I was in a boxcar going across Nebraska, and the train pulled out to the hole, went out to the farm. That means it pauses for a priority train, past the other direction, and I hear footsteps outside my boxcar that's at rest now, and somebody lightly jumped in and introduced himself, and it turned out to be Marcus Endicott, Lucian's son. So we rode to the National Hobo Convention together in Britt, Iowa. Then we turned around and rode freights back to Aspen, Colorado, where we both spoke at the ARIS conference. And we stayed in touch with each other till Marcus finally introduced me to his dad, Lucian, at the reunion about four years ago of the old IBMers. Marcus Endicott is very much involved in the National Rainbow gatherings in the party. He's been in the top of the circle for many, many years, throwing parties. That is rainbow gatherings in many countries, and he currently lives in Australia.
The two of you, as you said, were headed off to attend the National Hobo Convention. That's been running now for about 100 years out of the same location, has it not?
That's right. It's been held in Britt, Iowa. Britt, Iowa is a little sort of spur track off the main line south of Des Moines, the main line. So every year in the first weekend of August, hobos and tourists and whoever, carnies, whoever wants to go, gather in Britt, Iowa. Now there's about 10,000 people there for a very festive week of activities with hobo music and the hobo jungle and the election of the hobo king and queen and a midway carnival ride and so forth. Say about 10,000 tourists show up, but only about 30 hobos per year. And Marcus and I were two of them.
Only about 30 hobos per year. How about that? You would think the numbers would be a little larger, but that was one of the questions that we had in mind, actually, we're kind of throwing around and thinking about, was have hobos become a dying breed as compared to what they were many years ago, or because of recent economic conditions, has that forced a lot of people to take the route of what we've seen in days gone by, people hopping freights or thumbing, hitchhiking their way around to try to find some gainful form of employment?
Don't believe the articles and the books that you hear that are written and written along the theme of hobos are a dying to breed. Hobos are the dinosaurs of the travelers. Hobos are doing very well. In fact, leaving tomorrow at 2 o'clock out of the Colton Yard in San Bernardino, I'm taking two hobo webs, Crystal and Breeze. It's their virgin run on the rails. We're going to catch out of the San Bernardino Yard. And you really don't know which direction you're going to go as a hobo out of specific yards, and especially that one. The track bends south toward Yuma through Tucson and on to Texas, and about half the trains go north through Barstow and some bend up to Oregon, and the majority of them head toward Kansas. So we'll be catching the train tomorrow for their trial run, see if they'd like it to do a more distant trip this summer. As far as answering the questions, hobos ebb and flow with about three factors. When spring starts, say a month from now, about every other train west of Mississippi, you'll see a hobo on it, whereas back in the Depression, every train would have dozens of hobos on it. Now, if you go south into Mexico, where I've ridden the freight trains many times with the Central Americans, it's the greatest modern migration. They start at the Guatemala border, the Nicaraguans, El Salvadorians, Guatemalans, and Hondurans. And since they're illegal in Mexico, they have to ride the freight trains. They pile on the freight trains, 100, 150 per train on the top of them, like a little mobile village juggling along, card games and little shops set up and trees for umbrellas, moving along at 20 miles an hour through the Mexican countryside, and they're headed for the promised land, USA. So there are always large numbers on the trains in Mexico for that reason. In the U.S., the numbers swell with unemployment. After any war, they increased. When Ronald Reagan opened the psych wards and turned the people out, a lot of them took to the rails. And in poor economic times, they'll start riding the rails. Right here in Slap City now, there's quite a large contingent. They call themselves the Dirty Kids, the hobo riders distinguish themselves. They call themselves the dirty hobos that have caught the freight trains into here. There's a few dozen that I've met, and they'll stay around here for a month or so, and then they'll catch out again. Hobos aren't a dying breed. They'll always be around because it's such an efficient way to get around, as fast as a greyhound and much more fun. It runs along, the tracks run along the original rights of way, built in the 1860s through 1890s and on into the 1910s. And it's free. You don't need a ticket to ride the trains.
I myself did a fair deal of hitchhiking back in the day. Never jumped a freight. I considered it, contemplated the idea, but figured, well, you know, if I can make my way along the highways rather than having to ride the rails, that would not a problem. You know, we can do that quite easily enough. So they say, yeah, once you got the itch, the first time you jump a freight, that you suddenly catch the bug, I guess, and you want to keep doing it over again, from what people have told me. Let me just quickly go back, though, to what you said earlier about Ronald Reagan opening America's psych wards back during his time in office. Do you know any more about that as far as specifics or details are concerned? What happened? Why did he make that decision? What impact exactly did it have besides sending a lot of people out to live the life of vagabonds?
Well, I'm going back to my psych tech days. I got a degree in psych tech. I learned nothing in getting the certificate, but I did learn a lot in working at some psych wards around the country. There used to be a lot of psychology and psychiatry housing units for the people who were mentally disabled or pretend that they were mentally disabled. I mean, it's nothing. It's called taking a vacation. You act crazy on the road, police pick you up. They check you into psych ward, you put on a 72-day hold, determine if you're a danger to yourself and anybody else, and the travelers get the showers, good food, there's the opposite sex, clean sheets, drugs, and they're released in 72 hours and they're ready to travel again. For the 70s, there were hundreds of thousands in the psych wards and in the psych residential homes, and the president passed an order, I don't remember any more details, except for they passed a bill that released them, essentially forced them out, and the ones with more mental wherewithal jumped the freight trains, and they became one of the categories. I started riding freights in 1985. I would run into quite a few of them then. They were one of six or seven subcategories. There were the releasees from the psych wards. They were a minority. A lot of Vietnam vets on the rails end. Some of the other categories would have been the unemployed. There was the divorcees. There were just starting the young people, the road kids. And then there were people like me that are called boxcar tourists. Just ride the freight trains because it's fun. It's a blast. The general succession is, just to relate back to what you said a couple minutes ago, I also started out hitchhiking across the country, up and down the country, Canada, Mexico, other countries. And then I caught my first freight train in 85 out of Ogden, Utah. And there's a saying that piss out a boxcar once you're hooked. And that was it. I rode the train through Vegas, up to the Feather Canyon route, through Northern California, down through Sacramento, down into L.A., Skid Row there, stayed in the Midnight Mission, learned about that life. And I never went back to hitchhiking again. And that's pretty much the same general story that any of these people in Slab City or anybody riding the rails at present, and probably these two girls, these two ladies, hobolettes I'm taking out tomorrow, they've hitchhiked before. They won't stick their thumbs out on the highway again after they've ridden the freight train tomorrow.
Are these two ladies that you're taking out tomorrow a pair of your executive tour guide clients?
What you're referring to, I think, is the executive hobos.
Yeah.
In the 80s, mm-hmm. It was such a blast and such an outward-bound experience for me that I started taking some executives out that I knew from being a professional racquetball player and being in business. So I took out people like Doug Casey, the billionaire polo player, a couple dozen, about one every 6 months, and I still take them out. I have a website called WolkeelyTours.com. That's Executive Hobo Tours. I wrote a book that's at Amazon.com called Executive Hobo Riding the American Dream. So the two gals tomorrow, the two hobolettes, they're splendid. One is named Bree. She's from Massachusetts. She's hiked, former cross-country runner. She's hiked the Appalachian Trail. Then she welded one year. She's very pretty, but she has arms like Popeye with tattoos on them. And she stuck her thumb out and hitchhiked up to Slab City here about 2 months ago and discovered that I take people out on freight trains, so that's how we hooked up. She'll be going on the first ride. The other gal is sister, as she calls herself, from Detroit. Her name is Crystal Starr. You can find her online. She produced a film that won awards at the New York Film Festival and in Aspen, and it's called Culturenomics, C-U-L-T-U-R-E-N-O-M-I-C-H, Detroit, Culturenomics Detroit. And she got the bug travel for that. She drove her Winnebago out here about 3 months ago and heard that I take people out on freight trains. And so that's how that happened. We're not exactly executives. I don't take only executives out. I'm not an executive. But they'll have a good time, I think.
What do you charge for an adventure riding the freight? How long does it last? And what can people basically expect when they sign up and come on board?
I charge if they have fun. I demand that they have fun, and I've never been dissatisfied. Everybody has enjoyed. They learn after the first couple of days how to do it themselves, and about half of them have gone back and still ride the freight trains by themselves. So I don't charge anything, and a lunch sometimes expensive. What do they get out of it? The Outward Bound experience is that it opens up new world to them, so they have perspective. You might remember the first time that you traveled to another country. Now you had another country to compare U.S. to, and it gave you perspective. So they're kings in the office, and then they become kings of the road, and they like that comparison.
Yeah, how about that? It sounds like if I had the chance, I'd jump at that opportunity in a heartbeat. No doubt about that. So we're going to transition on to some new material and different ideas here. You're such an eclectic person, of course, with your life story and all the things that you've done over the course of your life in any number of different areas and categories. I want to see if we can get back in touch with Pirate Larry over in the Scurvy Dog Saloon. I know that you, Bo, had mentioned the Mexican experience and how it's a little different from what we see in the States. If Pirate Larry, is he there at all? Is he ducked out? Pirate Larry? Well, he might have stepped outside. I wouldn't be surprised if he's gone outside and standing around the bonfire that they've got burning out there on the beach with him and his Mexican amigos. So, yeah, so no luck there at getting his perspective on that issue. But let's, if we could, Bo, maybe transition to some other discussion topics. You've, I think, published around half a dozen books now, most recently. Oh, and before we do that, in fact, we need a pirate story. One of the ideas that I had, this is just formality more than anything, the way that Captain Long John Sinclair has things written into the ship's articles, that with each of the guests that we have visit us and come on board the Robin Hood, they're expected to share some sort of pirate story of some kind to one degree or another. But going through your Facebook pictures, we saw that you have a friend who had a parrot on his shoulder. He had to look a bit of a look of a pirate, to say the least. So who was this buddy of yours? I'm not sure if you have any other pirate stories to share on top of that, but who was this friend of yours in particular, and why the parrot?
Oh, you're referring to Ron Wheelock. One interesting thing that I've done in life was in 1999, I moved down to Iquitos, Peru, at the headwaters of the Amazon, in the Amazon rainforest. Let me back up about a million steps. I was walking Death Valley in 1998, walking the length of it. I'd seen Death Valley days and the Clydesdale horses, clomp, 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 and the alkaline dust rising from their hooves. And I thought as a kid, as an 8 and 9 year old, that's where I want to go one day. So in 1998, I finally made it there. I decided to walk the length of it. It was about 120 miles, about the sixth day, a couple days before the end of that hike, the length of Death Valley. I found a backpack in the sand with no tracks around it. And I was out of water myself. I was compromised. I was in a survival situation. So I quickly went through it. I took out a jackknife and I took out, a watch, and, there were some bus tickets, and I pieced together a little bit about this life. What's a backpack doing there without any footprints around it in a sand dune? So I completed the hike and, opened one of the letters of the envelopes that I had taken. I was, at that time, I came out of Death Valley in Laws, California, opened the letter, and it began, "Dear Hank, you don't know me, but I'm Susie, your daughter, who left me and Mom when I was a few months old, and I could practically see the teardrops on the paper, blue ink smeared, and it ended, please get hold of me, I still miss you, you're my father, signed Susie." She was from Kansas. So I called the park ranger. I said, "Belongings to Susie." Park ranger in the Death Valley went out in his Humvee, and he found the bleaching bones of Hank a few hundred yards from the backpack that I found, and he notified Susie. Susie came out to Death Valley, and they spread her father's ashes around the valley where he had walked and died. Apparently, he had run out of water and just dropped in his tracks. Since I found the guy, the California law mentality is that I was a suspect for the homicide. And I got badgered. Police dogs walking me. And it was in the news and the radio. So I left town. I went to the Amazon. And I lived in Iquitos, Peru in 1999. And that's where, to answer your question, I met the guy with the parrot on his shoulder. Now, you might say they're telepathic, but they have an excuse because they take ayahuasca. At least one of them does. Iquitos, Peru is the ayahuasca mecca. It's where the shamans are. It's where the ayahuasca vine grows. And it's where, since 1999, the ayahuasca tourist industry was just starting. Ron Wheelock at the time was a dirt floor Caucasian shaman. He was making no money, but he was big-hearted and he enjoyed what he was doing, and he was a great facilitator. He was a supreme of the streets psychiatrist. In a few years, Ron Wheelock, the guy with the parrot on his shoulder, became the top shaman in the world. Now he travels from country to country. He grew his own ayahuasca, and you'll find him online all over the place, Ronald, W-H-E-E-L-O-C-K. And that picture was at his compound down in Iquitos about 4 or 5 years ago.
So does Ron consider himself a bit of a pirate, or what of yourself? Have you you bonded over ayahuasca is kind of what it sounds like if I'm following you here. I'm not clear. Did you actually dose yourself with ayahuasca at that time as well?
What was your question again, please?
I'm sorry. Did you made your way down to South America? You said that you found yourself amidst part of the ayahuasca tribe and the very shamans that were ingesting ayahuasca. Have you yourself ever dosed?
As I said, Iquitos, Peru, on the Amazon River, at the headwaters, is the ayahuasca capital of the world. You read a lot about, or at least more now, about ayahuasca in the news, and it all started in Iquitos, Peru. Peter Gorman, former editor-in-chief of High Times magazine, was ground zero ayahuasca with his first published article that introduced ayahuasca to the world in the mid-80s. And then I met Gorman down there at this cold beer blues bar in Iquitos, and we hit it off, and I've lived with him for a while. Then I got introduced to Ron Wheelock, the guy with the parrot on his shoulder, not a pirate, but an ayahuasca shaman. Then I got introduced to Alan Shoemaker, who runs the International Shaman Conference every year for about 12 years running straight, and I lived with him in a backyard in a thatch hut for a while. It was like growing up with a new business or a new sport. It's infancy to its maturity now, and it was a blast. Ayahuasca is, Peter Berman called it the mind-bending drug of the world. It's the most powerful hallucinogenic in the world. I call it liquid psychiatrist. I've heard hundreds of stories. I've sat in on dozens of ayahuasca ceremonies with about 20 different shamans and seen some miraculous things. But in any experiment, remember, first and foremost, my background is in veterinary medicine, so I'm a scientist. I look through everything from a scientific eye. I watch the sunset here through my car window a little while ago, and I don't say how wonderful a sunset it was. I dissect the angles of the sun and the colors it produces. I was down there in Iquitos, part of the ayahuasca movement, as an observer. Thomas Edison said, the observer can't become part of the experiment or he might affect the experiment. So that's a long answer to, I've never taken ayahuasca, but I've done just about everything else about it, written many articles, met hundreds of people, and have a pretty good grasp of it for never having taken it.
Why is it exactly then, Bo, that you haven't taken ayahuasca? Maybe I'm not hearing what you're saying exactly, but I know that if I found myself in the middle of that environment, that I would definitely want to, I think it ties back to what you're saying earlier about Thomas Edison and the observer, I guess, and just remaining detached and objective. Is that correct?
Thomas Edison said that in any experiment, in any study, if you become part of the experiment, had I taken ayahuasca, I could no longer be an objective observer of it. That's why I didn't take it. I think what you might be hinting at asking is, why do people take ayahuasca? I didn't take it for the reason I just explained, and because it's so powerful. I've done drugs before. I experiment with a lot of drugs and with prescription drugs, Paxil, pharmaceutical, methamphetamine, and so forth. But I could see in the people that I observed, hundreds of them, that ayahuasca was too powerful for me, and I didn't have anything to solve. So why do people take ayahuasca? The main reason is to solve problems. As I said, I nicknamed it liquid psychiatrist. One good session of good brew, of good ayahuasca with a decent shaman is worth about 6 months on the psychiatrist's couch. I've seen this over and over again. Another reason it's done more, especially in the past 5-10 years, is as a recreational drug. And it's going to be the street drug of the future, I believe. In the 60s, in the 70s, marijuana swept the world. And in the 80s, it was, through the 90s, it was cocaine. And now it's amphetamine. I'm sitting right now in the amphetamine capital of Southern California, Slab City, manufactured here on the military bombing range. I'm a few hundred yards from other hidden labs. Some of them are underground, some of them are above ground. There's methamphetamine dropped in a certain little desert town from Mexico, about 3 hours here toward the Pacific Ocean. Millions of dollars worth twice a week flying in from Mexico and distributed by people on motorcycles. The incumbent worldwide drug sweeping the world conscious now is methamphetamine, and I believe it'll be replaced by ayahuasca. First $1 million shipment of ayahuasca went out from Iquitos, Peru about 2 years ago to, I believe it was Netherlands. Cells and churches are popping up in all states, in the United States and Canada, especially strong in Australia and in Europe, I believe France. Some countries in Europe have legalized it. I believe it will be the next world drug, and unlike the former drugs, unlike marijuana, cocaine, acid, I believe that ayahuasca will cause a shift in world consciousness. If anything will do it, ayahuasca will.
We have a friend, actually, via minds.com. His handle over there is Satori D, a.k.a. Daniel. And he actually has a show that he's put together in the past. I'm not sure if he's still managing to keep that on the go or not. It's called Psychedelic Sundays. So I think if you are interested, we'll mention his your name to him, as well as the story and your background. And we might be able to rig something up similar to what we're running here today, streaming live via YouTube. Got a handful of people that are about a half dozen or so right now, which is great, tuning in, watching things live. Most people download the podcast after. That's the way things typically work, just straight across the board with all shows. But yeah, if you're interested, we'd be more than happy to help the two of you get in touch and put hopefully a decent quality show together.
I'm an amateur. I'm an observer. This is a sidelight for me. My interests are other things. There's a saying in Peru, always go to the pilot. Always go to the head person. So I can put you in touch with the two and perhaps the three top ayahuasca people in the world, and I'm sure they'd be happy to do podcasts for you. They're famous, Peter Gorman, anybody who's involved in the drug culture, knows Peter Gorman from the famous High Times magazine where he was editor-in-chief. He now lives half the time in Iquitos and half the time in Dallas-Fort Worth, where he is a journalist for the Fort Worth Weekly. I call him Peter Gorman, Outward Bounds. He does two or three times a year, two-week-long expeditions straight into the Amazon, tromping through the jungles and the mosquitoes and the leeches. As part of that, every night the guests have options of taking the various hallucinogens and medicines, they call them down there. The Amazon is famous for San Pedro, mushrooms, ayahuasca, frog venom, the green frog that's a death rehearsal. Peter Gorman would probably do a podcast with your friend. The other person that would probably do a podcast with your friend, very smart, perhaps the smartest gringo down in the Iquitos, is Alan Shoemaker. He's run the International Shaman Conference for 12 or 14 years. Gorman has written the book Ayahuasca in My Blood and a follow-up book, and Alan Shoemaker has written two books on ayahuasca, Shoemaker. And you can email or Facebook, and I'll put you in contact with them.
Oh, it sounds great. We'll
I would have the parrot on his shoulder, too.
You said something about the pirate on Ron's shoulder?
I couldn't hear what you said, but I thought you said you called the parrot the pirate, and that's a good name for him. But you could call Ron Wheelock the pirate because he sails the air going from country to country, seeding ayahuasca around the world. But he's not a pirate. He's a former biker from the hills of Kentucky or Missouri, I believe, and got tired of what he thought was the mess the U.S. was heading into in the 90s and moved down to Iquitos and became a shaman and a very, very good one.
Well, that's great. Somebody perhaps that might even make for another decent quality guest. So he's definitely got that pirate look, the parrot on his shoulder and just his general visage and so forth. So what do you think, Valkyrie? Is that good enough for the captain and the standards that he's laid out there as far as managing to qualify to come on board the Robin Hood?
I think maybe we could convince him. No, I think it sounds just fine.
Can you interpret that question? What question did he ask?
I'm kind of playing around a little bit here, Bo, just asking Valkyrie if she figures that the captain will, if that will suffice, basically, the story that you've just shared with us here, and I'm sure that it will. So, in another thing, just going back to kind of tying things into what you had mentioned earlier regarding this pack sack you just mysteriously happened upon in the desert, quite a story indeed, but there was one time, might have been around the same period, in fact, where you found yourself caught up in an armed Mexican marijuana smuggling mule train through Copper Canyon. We want to hear about that.
I conduct tours at BoKeelyCourse.com. Most of them are hobo tours, but I also take people on expeditions, like survival expeditions. So 8 or 9 years ago, I hooked up with the Desert Survivors, they're called, an environmental hiking group out of the San Francisco Bay Area. I took three of them down, two ladies and a guy, good hikers, down into the Copper Canyon of Mexico. Now, the Copper Canyon is so large that it's said that you can drop about 5 Grand Canyons into it. The other thing the Copper Canyon of Mexico is famous for is the marijuana crop. Millions of tons of what we see up here in the USA and smoke comes from or used to come from Mexico. I met up with the X, Y, and Z down in the Copper Canyon. My method of hiking is not to go on a trail, but to start at point A and look at a map, topo map of the locals, and go to point B. And in this case, we were walking down the river through the Copper Canyon, no trail. Actually, they were old Spanish 1500s trails. We got a little bit bewildered, as Davy Crockett said, and pulled into a village of about 8 people where they had stacks and stacks of bags, burlap bags, full of marijuana in the schoolhouse, and more were coming in. It was a central place for that area, the Copper Canyon, during the marijuana picking season, and we had noticed it. The smell of marijuana was wafting up the canyon of this gorge that we were hiking along. So since we were lost, I asked the townspeople to lead us out, and they said, well, tomorrow morning, the mule train's headed out, and you can just follow them. So So the three of us got up with the sun. We had our coffee, walked up to the schoolhouse where there were dozens of burlap bags with initials on them of all the individual owners of the farms in the area within a radius of, say, 10 miles, and they had walked or floated or brought their burlap bags full of wheat into this central point in the Copper Canyon. And we followed a mule train downriver. By a mule train, I mean actual mules and actual mulas, which are people carrying it on their back, and horses walking through the water and along the shore. And we come to a confluence of another little stream, and more people were coming. Our small mule train joined another one and then another one, and we walked for about a day and got to a central meeting point where there was a dirt road, and everybody unloaded there and made a pile of marijuana, hundreds of burlap bags that were initialed, and it measured about 20 feet long by 8 feet wide by 10 feet tall, and they brought in a couple big trucks and picked it up, and hitchhiked a ride with one of the vehicles. I guess it must have been a cart or one of the trucks, and got out of the Copper Canyon, and that was my adventure there.
That's quite amazing. At any point in time, were you facing any risk, or were there any threats to your well-being at any point?
Before we left the village that morning, walking the riverbank with the mule team, I had talked with the people. I'm semi-fluent in Spanish. I told them that I had a teaching credential and was a sub-teacher, and talked to some of the kids, developed the rapport for the specific reason is that I didn't want to get my gang and my three people and me knifed or shot. And they actually invited me to come back later on and be a school teacher in this little town. Once I was able to do that, it was okay. And then I walked directly behind a guy carrying some a bag of marijuana. It was about a 30 kilo, maybe 70 pound bag of marijuana on his shoulders, and he had a pistol in his belt loop in his back. Other people were armed. We didn't get shot or molested in any way in the first hour, and so I knew that we were accepted. And then it was all downhill from there.
Yeah, not getting shot or molested, that's always a bonus. Never want that sort of thing to happen. You've just got one story after another here, obviously. So I think maybe now's a good time to transition on into your career as an author. I think you published close to around half a dozen books, and we started out trying to get into this earlier and then got a little sidetracked. Your most recent release is a book dealing with Elvis and his humor, Girls, Guns, Guitars, and Elvis's humor. So if you could fill us in a little more on that. Myself, longtime Elvis fan, we've got about a little over 20-some-odd books here on Elvis in the ship's library. So if that's any indication of the interest and fascination we have in him and his career and his character and so on and so forth. But yeah, if you could just tell us a little bit more about your recent publication and how that all came about.
Well, as usual, it's a circuitous answer. It starts back in 1972 when I was a racquetball player. I was the national champion in paddleball and in racquetball, and on the pro tour was ranked in racquetball number 2 to 4 for many years throughout the 70s. And I wrote the game's first, they call it the Bible, it's called The Complete Book of Racquetball. That was my first book, also my most successful book. It sold about 200,000 copies, and I got a taste of the author's life. Then I started writing The Rails. In fact, I transitioned out of racquetball as a pro player by riding freight trains to tournaments and to do clinics, jump out of boxcar. I had a Doberman with me and do a clinic, play in the tournament. And so I transitioned into being a hobo, and then I wrote the Executive Hobo book. Then I wrote a medical book with my background as a veterinarian and with shamans and with just street medicine, common sense, called Healy's Cures, K-U-R-E-S. Then they started flowing from there. Most of them are self-published. I self-published with Create Space. Elvis came in there as the most, most of them are travel adventure books. You can go to Steve O. Keeley, K-E-E-L-E-Y, author page at Amazon.com, and it'll have all 26 books that I've written there, mostly travel adventure. couple autobiographical series, and then Elvis comes in there. Through racquetball, I got an invitation to join the Elvis group. A number of the national champs, Davey Bledsoe, Randy Stafford, Steve Smith, Mike Zeitman, Sarah Green, they all knew Elvis. Elvis was a racquetball nut. He had built a court in his own backyard with a shower room that had old fixtures. Most of his band played, all of his bodyguards played. He brought a lot of the guys in from the Pro Tour that I competed against for money on the Pro Tour, played with Elvis, teach him. I never met Elvis because I turned down the offer. His group wanted to sponsor me. I was sponsored by another large company called Beach Industries, a racket manufacturer, and I rode with the brand. I stayed with Leach. However, 2 years ago, I started reading a little bit more about Elvis and talking to the guys who had lived with Elvis and played with Elvis and traveled with Elvis in racquetball. And I read 42 books, good books on Elvis, first-person, first-hand accounts of his life by the workers, all the way from his nurse to his kitchen help to his bodyguards that knew Elvis. And when I read 42 books about Elvis, there was a common thread throughout of it, a couple common threads. One was he loved sports. His first love was football. He was crazy about football. I loved it, too. It was my favorite sport even before racquetball. Second sport he liked was martial arts, and the third sport he liked best was racquetball. The other common thread in reading these 42 books was he had a sense of humor, hundreds of prank stories, a remarkable sense of humor. You might see a genius comedian. So I started marking these books early on, collecting the passages, made a stack about 2 feet high, and turned them into a sort of anthology with my own comments on the book Elvis's Humor, Girls, Guns, and Guitars. Now, as a PS, I can add to that actually isn't my most recent book. My most recent book, I just worked 5 days this past week, 12 hours a day. I just came off a 12-hour day of writing, and it'll be at Amazon.com in about 3 weeks, Slab City Tales from an Outlaw Town. And it's original stories that I've written in the last 2 years since moving here from the Ness Valley over my shoulder here. It's called Sand Valley, about 30 miles to the west. So that's my book writing career. I'm prolific, but not a poor starving artist, but I certainly don't make a lot of money publishing books, but I meet a lot of people.
Well, that sounds great. I think there's a lot of potential there with both, especially the two most recent publications, the Elvis book, as well as the one that you've got coming up. There's, I think, a lot of fascination that people, just outsiders, observers, have regarding the, you could say notoriety or reputation of Slab City. So, yeah, there's, now just quickly going back to Elvis, though, we can talk a little bit more about Slab City, of course, but didn't you, in fact, meet Ed Parker at one point? And Ed was, if I'm not mistaken, one of the King's martial arts instructors.
Strand of spaghetti on the plate again. Ed Parker played some racquetball, and he wrote a book about Elvis, but primarily Ed Parker is known as the founder of, I think it's called Kempo Karate.
Right.
It's a type of American karate. He's a very efficient grandmaster, or was, of martial arts. He entered Elvis' life and taught Elvis Kempo Karate martial arts. And if you watch the YouTube and look up Elvis martial arts, Elvis was hellacious. He was tough. He had those fast hands, a bit crazy when it came to physical contact. He didn't back down. There's story after story of Elvis defending himself and other people. So he was a proficient martial artist. But he was no Ed Parker. Ed Parker ended up throwing annually in Los Angeles International Karate Tournament. And through that, he met a guy named James Heidrick. And James Heidrick is the book I put out just before Elvis called James Heidrick in Photos. In 1981 through 1983, this character named James Heidrick was my roommate for a year, and he became known last across the tabloids, Star Magazine is the world's greatest psychic, quote-unquote. And then the world's greatest greatest martial artists. Front cover stuff of Karate Magazine, the martial arts magazine. No jail could break him. No guard could, no jail could hold him. No guard could break him. Patrick and I lived together, as I say, for about a year in 1981, 1982. And he went on to meet Ed Parker and train with him. Ed Parker called James Heidrick his son. And the angle for James Heidrick's book that I wrote is, as a celebrity martial artist, you'll find him all over YouTube. I have a website called James Heidrick Website. Click on my 10 most infamous roommates. He's in cellmates with Charles Manson, with the Alphabet Bomber, with many, many of the famous criminals in the past 20 years, because it's just like Hollywood. They tend to group together in the jail system, especially the California prison system. They put these celebrity criminals, they're called high power, high priority. They're sequestered in one area, and so he's there with the leader of the Aryans and Peg Leg Morgan, and James Heidrick has met them all. Trained by Ed Parker, who Ed Parker called Heidrick a son I never had. Ed Parker died a few years ago. Heidrick ended up becoming a mercenary for the U.S. and undercover inside and outside the USA. He served down in Central America in the Contra War and created some headlines down there. Came back to USA, ran out of money, and started with his martial arts skills and his ability. Colonel Bo Greitz called him, you're like a cockroach. You're better than a cockroach getting in and out of places. Not even a cockroach can go. He knew Bo Greitz. He knew Richard Marchenko, knew all the top martial artists from the Bruce Lee family and so forth. And James Heidrick, my buddy from 81, the world's greatest psychic, started robbing whatever he could rob, and they couldn't catch him because he was too slick. And once they caught him and he got on the FBI list, they couldn't catch him. They finally did catch up with him, and for the past 20 years, for 10 years, he has been in the prison system. And then about 10 years ago, they passed a law, and actually he was responsible for building a place called Coalinga State Hospital in Coalinga, California, outside the Bay Area. They needed some place to keep the celebrity criminals who have not committed any crime, but who might commit a crime. And so they created Coalinga State Hospital, and that's where Heidrick has been sitting for about 6 years for a crime he has never committed, but might commit.
Exactly what kind of crimes are we talking about here, Bo? Bank robbery or carjacking?
The crimes that he did commit were not what gets in the public eye and in the newspapers. Once you commit political crimes in another country with explosives and long-distance rifles, then certain organizations in the United States make sure you get put away if you can talk. Now, I don't think he ever got caught for robbery, but he did get caught for a sexual crime. In Huntington Beach, when he was doing the Ed Parker's International Karate Tournament, James Heidrick holds a Guinness Book of World Records for the breaking the most linear feet of concrete blocks, something like 19 feet of concrete blocks with a single blow. He got up on a ladder, broke it with his elbow, and did that in front of the cameras and so forth at Ed Parker's International Karate Tournament. During that period, in the 90s, I think, he got involved in drugs, specifically in one that's real hard to, easy to get on and real hard to get off, crack cocaine, and through that, he committed a sexual crime with an underage teen, and so was sex with a minor. They sent him to jail for that, and eventually to the psych ward, Coalinga State Hospital.
So presently he's being held in accordance with those charges, having allegedly...
No, the people at Coalinga have no charges against them. They've committed no crime. It'll be hard for you to grasp. That's the way it is. That's the California PSI industry, PSI-industry. It's like the military-industrial complex that Eisenhower warned us about in the 50s. This is a psychology industry, billion-dollar industry, especially up in the Bay Area, California. They created Coalinga State Hospital for former convicts that had not committed a crime. They'd served their time. Heidrick has served his time. All the other 1,200 residents, they aren't convicts. It's not a prison, like a huge psych ward with a mall, barbershop, capitalism. They have businesses there. It's a town. They'll never get out. Like a Twilight Zone. They're there for crimes they never commit. They can't be paroled. They're there for life. Deacon died last year from poor treatment, and the beds are filled because it makes the state money.
I'm sorry, how many people died there last year because of poor treatment?
I missed the question. Say it again, please.
You were kind of breaking up, too. You said, how many people died there last year because of poor treatment?
18 died last year of the 1,200, and on average, 10 to 16 died. I talked to James Heidrich a lot. I've interviewed him 200 hours. I visited him up at Coalinga State Hospital 1, 2, 3 times. So I'm doing a book on him. Well along on the book, it's my next one after this Slab City one. The one on Heidrich is called James Heidrich. That's incredible. And the poor treatment is by the security. They beat up the patient. Other patients beat up patients. The psych techs badger and don't take care of some of the invalids. Many of the residents there, Coalinga State Hospital, are seniors, and they get very, very poor treatment. Granted, it's a very tough place to work with ex-criminals that may or may not have, about half of them indeed do have a psychological problem, but there's a lot of bad treatment. They didn't all die of poor treatment, but many of them did. For example, the reason I published the book, James Heidrich in Photos, about 1 year ago, interviewing Heidrich on the phone, as I did for many, many nights in a row, and he said, well, there's a hit on me. I said, what do you mean? He says, I reported methamphetamine smuggling, Coalinga State Hospital, and I, Keeley, I wrote an article about it, and it got published in dailyspeculations.com, and it created a big ruckus. It gave rise to the eventual headlines that you'll find about 3 months ago, drug smuggling in Coalinga State Hospital. Methamphetamine is brought in the baggage, in the pockets, in the anuses, in the flashlights of the guards and the psych techs, brought into Coalinga State Hospital, which is like a little town, a lot of users of methamphetamine. And Heidrich reported it to me, and I wrote the article. Since they couldn't get to me, they tried to go after Heidrich. They came after him. He was walking down what's called the mall, which is just like any mall in America, only a smaller version. He was walking down the mall where there's a kiosk where there's a little camera, and that camera was off. That cued him. What did it cue him? He knows something's coming down. Three guys came at him with rock'em sock'ems. Three big Afro-American guys with rock'em sock'ems in their hand. A rock'em sock'em is a sock full of batteries. So you got Heidrich, three guys, they spread out around him. In 10 seconds, three guys were laid out. Heidrich walked calmly away and notified security, and that was that. From that point on, about a year ago, Heidrich became well-known. He had kept his previous career as the world's greatest psychic, as a martial artist, as a mercenary, jailbreaker, Guinness Book of Records. He had kept that quiet. But it's with the Rock'em Sock'em attack, and I published in about 6 or 7 days, James Heidrich in Photos, in order to stop further attacks and to notify the director and the staff at Coalinga State Hospital that he had a celebrity on his hands and they should give him the soft glove treatment. And indeed, he passed hundreds of books around Coalinga State Hospital, the staff, the director, the other patients all know about him, and they leave him alone now. We saved his life. He saved his life with his hands, and I helped with the book that I published.
You're saying then up until that point, people running the Coalinga State Psychiatric Facility had no idea who he was and his history, that he was had a celebrity-type status?
They didn't know except for at the very high, the director and perhaps the assistant director. And only one of the staff, who is an MMA mixed martial artist, knew that Heidrich was. I know it sounds strange, but he didn't talk about it to them. In all the previous jails he'd been, the worst hell holes in America, Folsom, all over America, he was the alpha. He was the top dog there, and he taught martial arts to prisoners and to the staff, to the guards. But in Coalinga State Hospital, he told me, there's some very bad people here, and I'm not going to teach any of them martial arts. And he never told anybody, except for at the top, they knew his background, one of the directors, and this one MMA guy. But when his life started being in danger, I said, we got, James, we got to get your name out. and we did, and he's a celebrity again among 12,000 oddballs there in Coalinga State Hospital.
Oddballs being the, unfortunately, the operative word.
Thanks for picking me.
Go ahead.
Some of them are very odd. Some of them are very dangerous. Half of them shouldn't be there. They're normal people. A couple of them could be mayors. A couple of them have been politicians, but they stuck them there. The other half are indeed oddballs. They're off their rockers. They're dangerous. They hurt each other. They rape each other. They have sex with the staff. They do terrible things. And those are the ones that I was thinking of when I used that adjective.
A real life one flew over the cuckoo's nest. So that's, in fact, now that we're on this discussion addressing this issue, a great idea for a show, of course, is the current state of the psychiatric industry throughout North America, and you know, this Coalinga State facility being definitely quite a highly notorious reputation. You're working on a documentary dealing with Heidrick, from what I can gather, doing a little bit of the research in the lead up to today's show. On top of that, I think you mentioned in an earlier little Facebook sort of a message exchange that we had that potentially we might be able to actually line up an interview with James live from where he's presently located. How's that looking?
That's not potential. That's done. He's ready for it. Be a great interview. I'll give you the numbers if I haven't already. I think I've given you the times to call him 2 hours every evening from 7 to 9. He's free on Fridays. You could get the inside story from the world's greatest psychic, the world's greatest martial artist, the world's greatest escape artist, one of the best missionaries ever who served with Bo Greitz and Richard Marchenko and other famous mercenaries, all rolled into one guy sitting there at Coalinga. He'd love to talk to you about it. And if you could be there with him, things would start to move around the room. I know that sounds strange. There's an explanation for everything. When he walks in the room, he's in a good mood. Things start to move. Papers, flags, and he can mess with your mind. So even for a tough pirate like you on the phone, he's a little bit of a telepathic. Go ahead and take a chance and interview him. I think your audience would love it.
Oh, I think it'd be great. Absolutely. That would be something for sure. So we're definitely going to have to get that booked, penciled in, and dates and times precisely nailed down and in place. So speaking of times, we're almost at the bottom of the hour. That means we're getting close to the end of the show. I'm not sure we've got, there's so many other topics, of course, that we could hit on. I think we've done a pretty good job, though, today, over the course of our discussion. The one thing that just quickly jumps out at me here is it's mentioned in your biography, this is kind of going back to Elvis and the whole rock and roll era and scene of the, you know, the 50s and 60s and so forth. You live for a number of years with the Woolies, who apparently were a backup band for Chuck Berry. Can you tell our listeners a little bit about that?
In the early 1970s, I went through veterinary school at Michigan State University. And it's the first 2 years, it's obligatory for students to live in the dorm. I wanted to get out, and so I took a room in a basement on what's called University Ave, close to the university, in the house where the Woolies band lived. Now, the Woolies were four mop-haired brothers called the Baldoris, B-A-L-D-O-R-I, from Detroit, Michigan. They had just had Who Do You Love, which is number two on the charts, a Bo Diddley song. They were a big name in Michigan and about to make it nationally, and they backed up Chuck Berry whenever he played locally. Boogie Bob Baldori, the eldest of the Baldoris, plays piano and a few other instruments, primarily piano, became a musician contract lawyer, wrote contracts for Berry and others, and played piano for Chuck Berry through Chuck Berry's death. I believe Berry died a few years ago. You can look up Boogie Bob Baldori and see that he's gone on to play the White House, Russia, Times Square, quite a piano player. However, back in the 70s, I was living in the basement that flooded every spring. I'd have my equine and bovine anatomy books out, surrounded by water, wade through it, go to class, come back. I was very much involved in veterinary medicine, and whenever the Woolies would practice upstairs, whenever Chuck Berry's coming into town, practice. dryer and study my veterinary medicine to drown out the practice, although they were very good. I had other things to tune into. Actually, I got talking and forgot what your question was. What was your question?
Oh, just the time that you spent living with the Woolies and that they were a backup band for Chuck Berry. Did you ever get a chance to actually meet Chuck? And on top of that, did I hear you correctly when you said that you think that he's actually died? Chuck Berry, that he's dead?
I thought he died a few years ago. I'm not sure.
No. He's,
I thought Chuck Berry died a few years ago. I did meet him a few times when he played locally. We went to the band and I and Chuck Berry went to a racquetball court in New York, actually. It was a private show for a wealthy person who had a racquetball court, and I gave lessons on the court, and Chuck Berry and the Woolies played there. I was introduced as the racquetball pro and the band psychologist. I had no special in with Chuck Berry. We had no rapport like he had with the other Woolies. I had good ears for music, but I didn't play. So I can't tell you. I have no Chuck Berry story.
Other than you spent a little bit of time with him and his backup band, and that if I heard you correctly there, that played a little bit of racquetball together.
Right now, about a quarter mile away, the mayor of Slab City, his father played with Chuck Berry. The mayor of Slab City is named Nutty Ben. If I yell loud enough, roll down my window here, yell loud enough, nutty, 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 he'd come running. Because in the early 80s, when Chuck Berry was still playing with the Woolies, this guy named Don Murawski, one of the most legendary criminals in Michigan, three-time loser, 23 years in the state and federal pens, he took over whatever, he's sort of a James Heidrick character, very charismatic, took over whatever prison or jail he went into. He gave birth to Nutty Ben, Ben Murawski, the guy who lives out here in Slab City about a quarter mile away. So in the 80s, Don Murawski, the criminal father, also a very kind-hearted, nice guy, human computer they called him. He worked at the vet school where I went to school. He challenged computers at the MSU computer laboratory and won. Very, very smart guy, but he was a strong-armed man and he wrote bad checks. Through that, Murawski family had a band called the Murawskis, and they played all the way up to the Jerry Lewis Telethon. The unfortunate problem was that if nobody in the audience applauded, if somebody in the audience didn't applaud after the Murawskis played, Don Murawski, father, the criminal, would go down and punch him out, and he punched out the principal of the school, and so they lost their sitting in the Jerry Lewis Telethon. And to come with the story, I borrowed Don Murawski's 69 VW van while he was fixing my more modern back then Chevy van. I was driving that van, came to railroad tracks, the brakes failed, a light came from my right, and boom, hit by a freight train in the old VW van, got scooped up on the cow catcher and was carried about 200 yards down the freight train track on this cow catcher, holding on to the steering wheel to keep from falling out the open driver's side window because the VW was folded into a V, and I could just see the wheels down there rolling and the rails and the sparks, and I thought that was it. I thought that was the end.
Jeez.
It wasn't the end because 40 years later, just 2 years ago, here in Slab City, I walked up to this fence and I said, I started talking with a guy I thought I'd never met before. I said, yeah, I'm from Michigan. He said, oh yeah, my dad's from Michigan. So am I. We used to play with Chuck Berry and we knew the Woolies. And I said, oh yeah, I knew a guy who went to school who did that. He said, my dad was there. I said, my dad had many degrees from Michigan State. And I said, well, the only guy I knew from Michigan State played with the Woolies was a three-time loser and spent 23 years in jail, and he had many degrees, but they were on the street, and he as a performer at the various MSU classrooms. And he looked at me and he said, Bo Keeley, I haven't seen you for 40 years. And it was Nutty Ben Borowski, his son, became the mayor of Slab City here. That's how I became, as I'm fond of saying, a made guy in hell here. Hadn't called it hell back in 1939. And I was a made guy because I knew the neighbor, and through that I am publishing Slab City Tales from an Outlaw City because it is a criminal town.
Well, that pretty much brings us full circle, the way we launched the show, of course, talking about Patton and Slab City, its notorious reputation, really. So I'm sure there's a lot of great and good-hearted people that look out for each other and follow and live their lives in accordance with certain codes of the road. But yeah, it can, I'd imagine it can be a little edgy and, you know, dangerous at any particular occasion as well, too. So, you know, we could go on at great length here once again, but, maybe what we can do instead is think about doing a follow-up show at some point, as well as perhaps getting you or some of the people, the names that you, suggested or recommended there, people that are involved in part of the psychedelic world and tied into the whole ayahuasca thing, have them turned on to our friend, Daniel, aka Satori D over at minds.com. Before we draw things to a close here, Bo, well, first of all, let's give Valkyrie, she's done a great job here, of course, really kind of doing her best to get the levels, the feed stabilized and the stream in place, everything taken care of from a technical standpoint, because the whole time, of course, you've been streaming and coming through to us here via speakerphone, which we're piggybacking through Kelowna, British Columbia, Canada. You, of course, being down Slab City. Valkyrie, do you have any just a quick question that you want to throw out and offer Bo, maybe something that we missed out on that didn't get addressed? I know the one thing really that kind of blew my mind is that his claim that he that this James Hydra character actually spent some time as a cellmate with Charles Manson, if I heard things correctly there. Bo, do you want to just quickly address that? Maybe give Valkyrie a few moments to get her thoughts organized.
I missed, was there a question in there for me? I missed it.
Did you claim earlier that James Heydrich was in fact a cellmate with Charles Manson?
In Los Angeles, in the L.A. County Jail, just as a quick sidelight, I know we're running out of time. I know the, I was a psych tech, but I know psych tech from both sides of the bars, from sprucing up inside and lock up, and then from the outside in treating the patients on the other side of the bars. And in the L.A. County Jail, same thing. I've been, I was thrown in there once for jaywalking, and I was a guest of the Catholic chaplain at the L.A. County Jail where Heydrich had been. Heydrich was in L.A. County Jail in the early 70s for robbery, and they sequestered him into a place called High Power, which was separate from the L.A. County Jail, an annex. And in that annex, they paid tens of thousands of dollars per day for certain celebrity criminals. And one of them was Charles Manson. They had cells next to each other. There was some kind of vent between them, or they could talk around the bar. And he told me, Heydrich told me some Manson things. He said that Manson told him, I'm trying to think of some things that you may not have read in the regular public news. He said that Manson told him that he did indeed give his followers, his flock, as Manson called them, he would give them acid and then give them hypnotic suggestions, go out and do his will. Heydrich thought that Manson was a little bit loony. He liked to psychoanalyze. He's a pretty good shade tree psychologist himself, and he liked to see what makes these people tick, and he decided that Manson had just probably taken a few too many drugs. He said he was very smart, but Manson could not stop talking. Talked all day, talked all night, talked in his dreams, just about nonsense stuff and rhymes and poems and about his flock of people. That's it that I can remember for Manson. Now, in the L.A. County Jail, down in a little underground facility called The Hole, I got a tour of it down there as a guest of a Catholic chaplain. It was like a cave with a cell on it, and next to it was a cave with a cell on it. And the alphabet bomber, Kovercevich, was in one cell, and Heydrich was in another cell. They were there in protective custody. Wherever Heydrich went, he was in protective custody. And, of course, the famous alphabet bomber, same thing. And according to Heydrich, this alphabet bomber, Kovercevich, was a genius, a very, very bright guy, so a lot of science. And he tried to recruit Heydrich into his group. Heydrich just says, no, I'm not a group guy. I'm a lone wolf. And according to Heydrich, as strange as it sounds, Berkovich, the alphabet bomber, taught him through the cell wall how to read minds and how to astral project. they would practice things like fill a glass of water a certain height in the water, and is the water a third full, half empty, then you astral project to a certain place, and I'll meet you there. So according to Heydrich, he got some of his abilities from the Alphabet Bomber.
How about that? Well, thank you for filling us in with these various anecdotes. Hey, Valkyrie, you got something for Bo quickly before we wrap things up?
Actually, something I found a bit peculiar, which the difference is between Canada and the U.S., is how you and the citizens have a export or more of an import of marijuana over there. Like, everything else is locally grown here, and that's really, it's a really strange concept for me, actually, growing up in B.C., because everyone's got a friend in high school that's locally grown in the Kootenays or Alberta or something, but you export, not the U.S. exports, but Mexico exports marijuana to the U.S. Is that an actual feasible?
Yeah, you know, you and Peter Gorman, the guru of marijuana smuggling, as a journalist and as a perhaps participant who knew many of the big, big marijuana smugglers, million-dollar ones, and the groups and the cartels over history. You and he ought to talk on a show together. But yeah, marijuana is, I don't know the status in Canada now, but state by state now in the U.S., as you guys probably know better than me, they're legalizing marijuana. And medical marijuana is a very big thing here in Slab City. In fact, marijuana is the barter in Slab City. Of the 200 hardcore citizens, they probably have $300 among them. But they all have marijuana, and so they barter with it. Many of them have medical marijuana licenses. Some of them grow. But it's still imported to a degree from Mexico. Now, the story I told about the Copper Canyon and being in the marijuana mule train, that took place of nearly a decade ago. Less and less is coming in, I believe, from Mexico. And more of it is being grown here, especially up in California in the Humboldt area. The main thing now that has replaced marijuana, especially here in Slab City, is methamphetamine. Now, Slab City is also known for some very, very positive things. Salvation Mountain, it's the last free place on Earth, or in America. It's where anybody can roll into town and overnight claim a piece of property, an old military slab, General Patton, park a trailer, build a tent on it, or build a shanty. This place sort of looks like Hooverville with marijuana barter and interesting characters from all over the country, thousands of them now. So I invite you to come see both negative and the positive aspects of it.
Yeah, I have to say that that's just such a, just from how I grew up, that's just a, such a bizarre concept, because though legally you can't say it, obviously, in statistics, but our number one export, especially from BC, is marijuana. We even have in Vancouver, it's called the Amsterdam Cafe, where the King of Pot usually, I forget his name, but he's just referred to as the King of Pot.
Prince of Pot, Mark Emery.
Right, yes, thank you. I've actually met him.
So have I. Not a positive experience, but we'll talk about that some other time.
It was positive for me. I'll have to see why it wasn't for you.
Oh, well, I'm sure there's a lot of great people involved as the marijuana, you know, anti-prohibition movement. This guy, though, not everyone is a huge fan of the guy. They, in some ways, they respect and appreciate what he's done, but then at the same time, he's received his fair share of criticism on top of that, too. Big major ego is kind of what a lot of it all goes back to. So, but that's another day and another story. Thank you, Valkyrie, so much once again for being a part of things here and helping to have the ship so that it's, you know, we're out and we got it sailing along smoothly here for today's show. We'll give you a 3-gun salute, I think is what the captain has said. But Bo, before we go, any websites? So, you know, you've got a few that you've got and maybe you'd like to share with our listeners. What would those be exactly?
A few that I've mentioned is, for an overview, go to Bo Keeley, K-E-E-L-E-Y, Steve Bo Keeley Wikipedia. The website for Hobo Tours is BoKeeleyTours.com. The primary website, which is being worked on now, and in about 5 days, the sort of hub for all my websites is called CatmanKeeley.com. Catman is my nickname from supposedly having lived 9 lives or 9 deaths other websites would be the James Heidrich, H-Y-D-R-I-C-K, webpage. And there are a couple good interviews. One of them is in Elvis, Australia. A few months ago, did an interview with Keeley. Then the most recent article is in Mother Jones, the exciting and possibly true adventures of Bo Keeley and executive and his executive hobos.
We will try to add as many of those as possible to the show notes. In the meantime, just a big thank you once again to Valkyrie for helping to keep the show running here and the ship afloat. Bo, I'm not sure if there's any last thoughts that you've got to add here or comments or things that you'd like to let our listeners know besides taking the time to drop by and visit, you know, a few of your websites. Anything else that you'd like to throw out there for people?
No, it was an easy sail tonight, and I'd be happy to join you again.
Well, it was really great, and a big thanks, of course, to Bathtub Jen. I know she was there at the start of the show listening to things live here as we were streaming via YouTube. A handful, about a half a dozen or so people stuck with us throughout the duration of things here tonight, so which, of course, is about now 10 to 3 p.m. Saturday afternoon here in South Korea. In the meantime, folks, yeah, that's about it. It's a wrap for today's episode. Be sure to drop by our website, WPRPN.com, where we've got the great new link to our Patreon account set up. Looking for some sponsors, patrons there, of course. The first 10 that we managed to get on board, we're going to offer exclusive access to a few months of our after-show content. I'm not sure, Bo, speaking of which, we have this after-show Rogues Gallery end of things that we put together. Have no idea if you're going to be able to stick around for that or not, but if we can manage that, that would be great. We'll maybe talk about that after we wrap things up here. Next week, of course, we've got the Fukushima special coming up. Lord Stompy is going to be dropping by and joining us. He's been doing a fair deal of research and investigation into the whole Fukushima disaster. Our friend Moto, once again from Japan, will be playing a part in things hopefully as well, so people can look forward to that. And let's not forget, we do have an exclusive 90-minute time slot set aside just for Valkyrie in a couple of weeks, so we can hear from her and a lot of her stories, things that she's seen, experienced over the course of all of her 20 huge years living on this planet we call Earth. You can easily find us on YouTube, Facebook, of course, Pirate Radio Podcasts, Minds.com, Twitter, all sorts of various social media connections and projects on the go. In the meantime, that would indeed be a wrap until we meet again out on the high digital seas somewhere, hopefully a little further on down the road. I'm your host, as always, Jaffe Ryder, Chief Communications Officer of the Robin Hood, signing off. Meet you further on the road.
living out in the desert.